Good morning. The comedian Ruby Wax is screamingly funny, very bold, and her high-octane interviewing technique has often booby-trapped celebs into revealing far more than they ever wanted. But she's also disarmingly honest about her own life, in particular that she suffered from clinical depression and was hospitalised. She was Marion Finucane's guest last Saturday.
I had my third child. He said, "You have clinical depression." I didn't know that before. And then once he told me, I was really happy because then you have medication. Otherwise, you just think, I don't quite understand why I go into this kind of hibernation state.
Yeah. Frightening?
Not frightening, dead. Just dead. You have no feelings when you're that crazy.
How did you perform?
Oh, I never had it when I was performing. I was lucky until the very end that I wasn't working.
Yeah.
You can't work when you're really ill. You can't fake this. Otherwise, everybody'd fake it.
Ruby's new book is called Sane New World, Taming the Mind, and it is, as she says, neuroscience for dummies.
Your mother was a very unusual woman. Tell us a little about her.
I mean, it's impossible. It's the A-list of madness. But, of course, nobody knew what it was then. You know, a woman on all fours with sponges attached to her knees and her hands, like those pool cleaners. But that wasn't the only thing. She tried to set buildings on fire. You know, I mean, it became very crazy. But nobody said the woman has depression. They said she's having a change of life. And I said, but she's 87.
But she was obsessive about dust and cleanliness.
Yeah, but that wasn't the end of it. You know, OCD isn't the bad thing. The madness is the screaming and the full Monty.
Yeah.
Of that hysterical voice. This was her saying hello. So she was in a state of total anger.
Ruby believes that we've become slaves to busyness and that we worship those who live frenzied lives. She says it's time to get off the merry-go-round and practice mindfulness, forget the past, stop imagining the future and live in the present. Easier said than done.
You say that when your kids were young, you were just so busy that you can hardly remember it.
I was seduced by my job. So I wanted, you know, you're chasing somebody else's tail. And it was really seductive. But I couldn't come home at night and cool it. I was still on the phone chasing. So my son used to cry and say, "Can you not hang that phone up?" I think he's a little affected by it to this day. He really was distressed. And I go, "Yes, I promise, Max, but I was still on the phone. I still had the phone at my ear."
And how did your husband cope all this time?
Oh, he's a trooper. I married him on purpose because he comes from an army family and they're used to war. They thrive in war. So I handpicked him because I knew who else could tolerate me. He was younger than me and now he looks like my father. I've aged him. Don't tell him.
No, I won't.
Ruby Wax. Well, Ruby and Graham Norton used to write an agony aunt column for the Daily Telegraph, and you can imagine what that was like. Graham ran out of Ireland as fast as he could 30 years ago. He settled in Britain and made a new and very successful life as a chat show host. But as he told Miriam O'Callaghan, he originally wanted to be an actor.
After I left drama school, I really didn't work. But then the wanting to show off gene bubbled on. So I started writing little things for myself. I also hated the passiveness of being an actor, where you have to sit and wait for the phone to ring.
For people to give you work.
Yeah, it's miserable because there's no control. Whereas in stand-up, there's control in that, one, you're writing what you have to say, but two, you are making calls and saying, "Do you have any gigs coming up in the next few months?" You drive your own work. And that suited me much better.
But his mother, Rhoda, worried about the fact that he was gay.
The thing the parents say is the word, it's going to be a lonely life.
Yeah.
Because at that stage, I mean, now obviously things have changed, but at that stage, it was a life without marriage, it was a life without kids. So I totally get it, because it's an alien choice. She's got over that now, and
yeah.
She sees that, you know, I've made my own family. That's a family of friends, and it's a...
And the millions who watch you.
Well, there's that, but that's kind of a weird thing, you know,
Did you once say that growing up as a Protestant in Ireland was almost more difficult than being gay?
I think it was very confusing for me. And it sounds like a joke, but I remember seeing a play, and they said something that growing up gay in a small town, it made you feel foreign. And I think I associated a lot of those feelings with growing up Protestant, which you are made to feel slightly like an outsider, slightly not quite in the in crowd. So for me, seriously, a lot of those feelings, I think, of otherness, of separateness, I just put down to, well, I'm a Protestant. And it was only really that when I left, I kind of got, oh, no, there's more going on. There's more going on than Protestant.
Not just being Protestant.
Yeah.
Graham had a fractious relationship with this country, but he says it took the death of his father for him to appreciate what Ireland has to offer.
I didn't come back a lot. When my father got ill, I would fly in, see my mom, we'd go to the nursing home.
Yeah.
You know, I'd spend some time there.
Your dad had Parkinson's.
Yeah, my dad had Parkinson's, he was in a nursing home. So I would then go back to London. When my father died, suddenly I was a different person. I was an adult. You know, that's in anybody's life, that's a big growing up thing. It's so weird when you're in a hospital and doctors are talking to you and you're like, don't talk to me. Yeah, why are you telling me this stuff? You know, where's my mom? Tell her. When I came back, yeah, I felt like a grown up, and I got it in that weekend, in that time around the funeral. And you just saw how people dealt with death, and it made me really like Ireland and admire Ireland. And I go, yeah, we got this and we do this better. There's no embarrassment. You know, I think if you lose someone in Britain, people slightly feel like you've farted or something. You know, there's kind of a looking away, kind of, ooh, just wait till they stop crying and then we might talk to them. Yeah. Whereas in Ireland, you just face it full on and it's kind of going, your dad's dead, and I'm really sorry. And, you know, here's a cake. Yeah. And previously, I'd have thought, what the hell are they doing with that cake? But of course, it's a lovely thing to get a cake. And it's lovely that people come to your house and tell you stories about your dad, and you find out things about your dad you never knew when he was alive. And you see aspects of your father. And it was brilliant.
Graham Norton with Miriam O'Callaghan last Monday. Do you ever wonder if someone is listening in on your phone conversation or spying on you when you're on the internet? Well, on Sunday night, the debate over privacy laws and the public good was ignited when Edward Snowden, a former CIA employee, revealed that he was the whistleblower who'd leaked information about the American government's cyber surveillance program called PRISM. Edward Snowden, who's now in hiding, accused the US intelligence agencies of subverting the power of government and threatening democracy.
I'm just another guy who sits there day to day in the office, watches what's happening, and goes, this is something that's not our place to decide. The public needs to decide whether these programs and policies are right or wrong. And I'm willing to go on the record to defend the authenticity of them and say, I didn't change these. I didn't modify the story. This is the truth. This is what's happening. You should decide whether we need to be doing this.
Edward Snowden. Well, back in the 70s, investigative reporter Carl Bernstein, along with Bob Woodward, broke one of the biggest scandals in American political history and exposed the Watergate cover-up, which eventually led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon. Carl Bernstein is in Dublin to take part in the Dorky Book Festival, and he spoke with Pat Kenny yesterday.
Let's talk about what Edward Snowden did.
Yes.
I mean, were you shocked by the revelations, first of all? Do you think it was proper and ethical what he did? Is he a whistleblower to be admired?
Complicated questions all. But first of all, let's look at what the nature of the information is. That is to say, it is a huge data mining operation. And we do not yet know of any abuse of that information once gathered. In other words, the government is like a giant vacuum cleaner sweeping up all of this information, but it's not, as far as we know, listening to it. It's looking for a needle in a haystack because of the extraordinary situation that we have with terrorism today. There is an inherent conflict between civil liberties and fighting terrorism in a way that perhaps we've never had that conflict quite so confusingly before. But I think it's much too easy to see this particular instance of the NSA in terms of government listening to us and surveillance of us. I'm not sure we're there yet. In terms of Mr. Snowden, we have, for good reason, laws that say that those who are entrusted with genuine national security clearances are obligated by the oath they take not to disclose the same. There are times...
At what point can you breach that oath? I mean, if, for example, there's some crime being committed against individuals, does that liberate you from your oath?
I think, again, those who decide that there is a crime being committed and that they wish to expose it, do so understanding the risks to themselves. Some are very courageous in doing it and do it for the right reasons, and some do it for the wrong ones. I'm not sure of the answers in this particular case yet. I think that it's a little early to be treating Mr. Snowden as a hero here.
Carl Bernstein. Well, Senator David Norris's personal life came under intense scrutiny during the presidential race, and he said he suffered a nervous breakdown and depression as a result. But judging from his conversation with Miriam O'Callaghan on Tuesday, he hasn't lost his fire, or as he put it, his savage indignation.
I'm angry about the Senate.
But you are a senator, David.
Of course I am. And I'm not going to be told by anybody like Enda Kenny or anybody else. And particularly the three they had on Sunday, who were all ex-senators. Hello, hello, Pascal O'Donoghue, Brendan Howland and Alex White. The Senate suited you bloody well when you're using it to parachute yourselves into the door. And then you come round and you say it was all a waste of time. Really? It was a waste of time for Douglas Hyde, the first president, for our current president, Michael D. Higgins, for Mary Robinson, who did a hell of a lot. And they're telling me that I wasted my time for the last 26 years. I don't think so. Don't think I wasted my time when I got the first debate on AIDS, when the Dáil were afraid to do it. I don't think I wasted my time when I got the Foreign Affairs Committee, which the Dáil failed to do. I could go on and on and on, but it would be every other person. Fergal Quinn, Joe O'Toole, Ronan Mullen, Sean Barrett, who has been stunning. All those amendments into the bill. Joe O'Toole and myself got six amendments into the NAMA bill that the Dáil had failed to do. I put the bondholders' names on the record, which the Dáil were afraid to do. And, I mean, I'm not going to be told by Enda Kenny that we never challenged the Celtic Tiger. I certainly did. I voted against the bank guarantee. I voted against benchmarking. I voted all the way along when he was leading his troops in to vote in favour of everything that betrayed this country. So, Mr. Enda Kenny, please start telling the truth. Please do not be so disingenuous about Seanad Éireann. Explain to the Irish people why you did such a somersault on it and why you refused absolutely to let the people discuss it in the convention. And I'd like to end by saying I'm repeating my challenge for the fourth time to the Taoiseach. Meet me in public. Debate this.
Senator David Norris. And on Tuesday, we got to hear an example of what passes for intelligent debate in the Upper House as Fianna Fáil Senator Mark McSharry let rip about an Taoiseach's views.
We see him clowning around Europe, as it has to be said, acting like a clown, turning a circus ring of government and indeed the
object,
office.
I object.
I have a question for the leader.
I object to that kind of language in relation to the Taoiseach.
From Wednesday's Morning Ireland. The Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill was finally published late on Wednesday night. It will allow for the introduction of abortion in limited circumstances more than 20 years after the X case. It's always a divisive issue, and while the Catholic bishops called for a free vote, Taoiseach Enda Kenny was unequivocal. He insisted that if anyone in Fine Gael voted against the party line, there would be political consequences. He described what the campaign had been like, and he put down a clear line in the sand in the separation of church and state.
This is a sensitive issue. I am now being branded by personnel around the country as being a murderer, that I'm going to have on my soul the death of 20 million babies. I'm getting medals, scapulars, plastic fetuses, letters written in blood, telephone calls in the, all over the system. And it's not confined to me. Not confined to me. Now, I want to say this clearly. Everybody in this country is entitled to have their say. I saw the response from the meeting at the weekend. And I do not agree with many of the statements that have been made. Don't agree with them. My job as Taoiseach is to lead the government in governing for the people of our country. It is not confined to any sector of the people. It is for all of the people. Therefore, I am proud to stand here as a public representative, as a Taoiseach, who happens to be a Catholic, but not a Catholic Taoiseach.
Taoiseach Enda Kenny. The report into the death of Savita Halappanavar was finally published on Thursday afternoon. The chairman of the HSE investigation, Professor Sabar Atnam Arul Kumaran, spoke with Mary Wilson.
There's a question asked, I think, up and down this country since news of Savita Halappanavar's death broke in the Irish Times last year. Why did she die?
The issue here is actually from the time of admission,
There have been a number of episodes where they could have acted differently. To start with, they did a white cell count, which is a general idea about whether there's infection or not, but the doctors did not really look at the report. If they would have looked at the report, they might have repeated the white cell count. Then the second is actually when the pulse rate went up, they should have done repeated observations more closely. And although the guideline says every 4 hours, they didn't even do that. So that is midwives as well as doctors, the clinical team. And even when the pulse rate went beyond 100, they didn't. Normally, you don't wait for 4 hours. You would like to do it again in 15, 30 minutes. And if it is still raised, they should have done additional blood tests. If these were pointing towards possible infection, then they should have really reassessed Savita's condition and decided what would be the next step. So it's not one particular issue, but one after the other, like a domino effect. Things have been happening, and finally she lost her life due to severe sepsis and septic shock.
You're describing, are you, failures at every level from her admission?
That is correct.
Professor Sabaratnam Arulkumaran with Mary Wilson on Thursday's Drive Time. And the issue was also discussed on The Gathering yesterday with Olivia O'Leary, Tim Pat Coogan and psychologist Ian Robertson.
Olivia, do you think that it'll make any difference, the passage of this law? Do you think that the report itself will actually ensure that this does not happen to another Savita?
Talking to a consultant in this area, and I said to him exactly, you know, raise the point that you've made, that actually this doesn't guarantee that Savita or a Savita case would never happen again. And as long as we have a situation where it's a matter of a risk to the mother's life rather than a risk to the mother's health, this could arise again. And indeed, the professor involved in bringing out the report said that very thing. But this consultant pointed out to me, listen, in a situation where we have any doubt as to whether we can intervene at a particular point and anybody might be looking over our shoulder that we might be worried about in terms of accusing us of having acted precipitately, we say one word, he said, we say Savita. But we should not be relying simply on the memory and the shame of one woman's death.
Well, I often think Savita, as a qualified dentist, would have known what sepsis was, yeah. Probably would have known exactly the dangers to herself. Yeah. Tim Pat?
As an Irishman, I'm ashamed about what happened to Savita. It's clinical, it's inhuman, it's in the line of the Inquisition, not in the line of a carpenter in Galilee.
Ian?
There was two sides to this. There was the constitution, which played a part in her death, and the second thing was an embarrassing and shameful lack of process, proper medical process in Galway University Hospital. It reeked of third world healthcare, to be quite frank.
From the Pat Kenny Show yesterday, which broadcast live from the Dalkey Book Festival. Well, Olivia O'Leary also reviewed the newspapers with David McWilliams.
Any last stories you want
Matt
to mention?
Matt Cooper fulminating about Fintan O'Toole fulminating about cyclists. It is such fun. Fintan O'Toole, you know, who's a very calm man, had an enormous go at cyclists. And I must say, I sort of agreed with him on an awful lot of fronts.
What was he saying?
He was basically saying that they were the spawn of the devil. You see, he didn't actually sit on the sidelines on this one. And certainly, if you're driving, particularly when you're driving along the Rock Road, you know, and coming in, and you're desperately trying not to kill a cyclist. I get into the car every day and I say, please God, let me not kill a cyclist
today. How many
have
you killed so far?
Some in my head, but not in fact. And they weave around in front of you.
They break every traffic light.
They break every traffic light. And then they come and they bang on the top of your car, you know, because you didn't take enough notice of them.
That's only when you just...
Oh, sweet God.
Well, if you don't get them with the car, you might get them with the side. I'm going to defend the cyclists here. I think
and they're so holier than
thou. No, I'm not being holier than thou.
Can I just ask everyone to pause for a moment and just think of this image, David McWilliams on a Sunday morning with his pals in Lycra.
Olivia O'Leary and David McWilliams. Well, the late Maeve Binchy was also remembered during that outside broadcast from Dalkey. Pat Kenny spoke with her husband, the writer Gordon Snell.
As a writer, though, how would you categorise her?
I would say curious. Curiosity was her main policy, really. She was just curious about everything, about particularly people. And that's why she never minded being delayed at airports or bus stops or whatever, because she'd always, not only the famous listening at a distance and or eavesdropping and so on, which she did in spades, but just that she would speculate always. She said, what is that man over there doing with that heavy case? Is it full of stolen spoons or contraband, or is he going to see his wife, or is he running away from his wife? You know, any person or any incident would spark a story.
Did that change as she became celebrated as a writer and very well known? I mean, Maeve sitting on a bus eavesdropping was no longer really possible because everyone would be aware, there's Maeve sitting behind me.
I think she could still do it. She used to say, I just lurk. I kind of skulk in the background and don't look the full shilling. And people just think, oh, I'm just some odd person wandering by, and they take no notice. But, I mean, she could lip read across a room. This was an amazing facility, particularly if you're having a tete-a-tete dinner with her. She would say, what are you having next? And she'd be talking to me. And then she'd say, I must know what happens to that couple. I'm going to stay on for second cup of coffee. It would turn out that they were about to leave each other and they come on this as a last holiday or something like that. And she really could hear what people were saying way across the room, which is startling.
I think wives generally have a way of talking to a third party while also listening to the conversation the husband is having with the pretty girl across the room.
Yes, I think women, this is true, do multitask much more than men. I find that very difficult. We worked side by side in our studio room upstairs, and Maeve could answer the phone and then go immediately back to the paragraph she was writing and take it up where she left off. Or she could even listen to a radio program and type a novel at the same time. Excuse me, Pat, but even you, she could write Tara Road while she was listening to Pat Kenny.
From Today with Pat Kenny Yesterday, produced by Donal O'Herlihy.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
There was huge embarrassment this week for the chairman of the Public Accounts Committee, Deputy John McGuinness, when it emerged that taxpayers had funded foreign trips for his wife when he was a junior minister. On Wednesday, he temporarily stepped down as chairman, and Fine Gael Deputy Simon Harris questioned him about the matter.
So you yourself made the choice that your wife's cost of travelling abroad should be met by the department?
Yes, I allow that to happen, yes.
Okay. And do you, with hindsight, regret that?
Well, I suppose hindsight is a great thing,
Deputy
Harris.
But that's all we can have when we're dealing with
this. As I said to you now, that if it were today, would it happen? No, it wouldn't. I'd have had a better call on it.
Deputy John McGuinness heard there on the News at 1. As if the Leaving Cert wasn't enough of a nightmare, math students got a real whammy when it emerged that there were serious mistakes in the actual exam questions. Catherine Lewis of the Mathematics Teachers Association explained it all to Cathal McCullough on Morning Ireland.
What was the error and what was its effect?
Basically, on the English version of the paper, there were two errors. One error was if you read the English language, it says that the ship turns through an angle of 124 degrees, which would mean that that should be an exterior angle to the triangle. In the diagram, it is an interior angle. However, most students would just go straight to the diagram and work from the diagram. And that was fine. You start working from the diagram. It seems a very easy question. And many students, and I want to reassure them on this, they would have dropped the vertical down, used the basic idea of the sine is the opposite over the hypotenuse, and got a value for the height of the triangle. Very good students, however, might have wondered why such a trivial question was on an honours Leaving Cert paper. So they might have checked their answer, which can be done on a calculator in 2 seconds using the other side of the triangle, and then you get a different answer. And then the very good students start wondering, you know, the same triangle can't have 2 different heights.
If you were doing it through Irish, was there no problem?
Well, there was a problem. In the Irish paper, as I understand it, the angle of 36 degrees was left out. The problem on the English paper is that the triangle is not consistent. The 36 degrees is a wrong angle.
Yeah, but in Irish?
In Irish, they didn't put it in, so they could have worked out the question. However, the invigilators were alerted to the fact that it was missing the angle of 36 degrees. So they, as I understand it, announced to the students to put in the angle of 36 degrees.
So
everyone had the same problem.
And I still don't understand it, Mammy. Catherine Lewis with Cathal McCullough. The legendary 60s folk singer Judy Collins was Evelyn O'Rourke's guest on Arena, and Evelyn joined her at the piano for a trip down memory lane.
My life just changed. I decided I had to sing them. Then I became a member of the folk music club in Denver, and I started going up to Lookout Mountain and drinking homebrew and listening to everybody sing versions of "This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island." And I was properly hooked.
And then, of course, New York in the early 1960s. And there's a real romance about that time because the folk music scene there was really blossoming. Can you bring us back to that time?
Well, it was an incredible time. I moved to the Village quite early. I had already a recording contract with Elektra by 1961. Everybody was there, you know, we'd go walk down the street and Tom Paxson would come along and say, well, I've got this new song, bottle of wine, fruit on the vine, when you gonna let me get sober? So I'd record that, and I recorded Pete's songs and Woody's songs, you know. So pretty soon, most of the singer-songwriters in the Village had been offering me up songs, and I'd been recording them for Elektra. And then when I really got into the groove of it, I recorded Ian and Sylvia and Ewan McCall. I recorded a number of songs written by Peggy and Ewan.
And people like Leonard Cohen and Joni Mitchell are also on your list of people that you championed. What was it that you heard in their music that made you feel that it was something you wanted to bring to your audience?
Well, I was introduced to Leonard by my friend Mary Martin, who knew him from Canada, and said, this guy's a wonderful poet, and he's also a novelist, but they're very, let's say, obscure poems and obscure novels, but he's writing songs now, and he wants to come to New York, and he wants to play you a song or two or three and see if you think they're really songs. So he came into my house and he said, I can't play the piano. I mean, no, he couldn't play the piano ever. And I can't sing. And then he said, and I don't know if this is a song. And then he sang me this. Suzanne takes you down to her place by the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night beside her, and you know that she's half crazy. That's why you want to be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China, just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her.
Judy Collins with Evelyn O'Rourke from Tuesday Night's Arena. Punk poet John Cooper Clark was a guest on Arena on Thursday. The self-styled Bard of Salford spoke with Sean Rocks.
Do you know, I think poetry should have its own music. You know, that's what it is. That's why it's a poem, because it's a music made out of language. You know, I don't think about it too much. I just write the shit. But this one's called Avocado Vignette. So my latest one, Avocado Vignette. See what you think. Their gripes give way to bravado. They got a rat for a pet. The house is all avocado. All avocado vignette. Avocado walls and floors. Avocado slates. Behind those avocado doors, what crackpot actually owns this place? The bride was a bruiser from Broughton, abroad with her brains in her bra. The groom was straight from Stradorton, with a skateboard instead of a car. Wed in a shed in Prestatyn. Since then it's been love on demand. In the language of dirty dog Latin, she knew like the back of his hand. He had an eternal erection. With abstinence had he no truck. She couldn't tell sex from affection, and both of them fertile as fuck. They had about 28 children with names nobody can spell. Everyone's threatened to kill them, the knockabout neighbours from hell.
Avocado Vignette, the latest poem from John Cooper Clark and heard on Arena. Well, the good weather is a distant memory now, but callers to Joe Duffy on the live line this week were critical of the behaviour of young people on our beaches. Eileen runs Maud's ice cream parlour on the Hoth seafront, and she's refusing to serve ice cream to young girls who are inappropriately dressed.
Eileen, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
When you refused to sell them the 99s or whatever, what was the reaction?
Well, they weren't too
bad, actually. They did leave the shop, but they were dressed in string bikinis. So we said they weren't appropriately dressed, and they had a few swear words and things. It wasn't too bad. There wasn't any violence or anything. We just felt that they weren't appropriately dressed, so we weren't going to serve them, you know.
So you wouldn't sell ice creams to anyone dressed in a bikini?
No, not on the seafront in Howth. We're directly across the playground with the children, and we're quite a family-orientated shop. And they're not appropriately dressed to be walking up and down the street. There's another ice cream parlour not too far, an ice cream shop on the East Pier, who had put up a message yesterday, unless you're appropriately dressed as well, they're not going to serve them.
There's signs up now in Howth saying, if you're wearing a bikini, we won't sell you ice cream.
Yes, yeah. Well, we haven't put the sign up, but we won't serve people who are inappropriately dressed, no.
But it's kind of bizarre, is it not, Eileen, that in the soaring temperatures, a company that sells a product that thrives, thankfully, when the weather is hot, is saying we won't sell you ice cream when you're dressed appropriately for the weather.
Well, you're not really dressed appropriately walking along a main street. You're dressed appropriately for the beach, in fairness. I think it's really hard for us as businesses to be held to ransom by 14 and 15-year-olds, you know. We've gone through a long, hard winter. We've gone through a long, hard few years. Most businesses are struggling. That's the message we want to send out to people, is that bring your family out, look at the seals, have a best of fish and chips, you know, have a drink, have an ice cream. It's a great place to come. Get the dart out, leave your car at home.
But don't dare show up in a bikini.
No, exactly. And I know you're laughing at that, but I don't think it's appropriate for the main street in a shop that has lots of children and lots of mummies and daddies.
That won't be an issue in this weather. Una Kavanagh's problem was much more serious. She's of Vietnamese descent and was assaulted on Parnell Street in Dublin.
Una, what happened to you 2 weeks ago on Parnell Street in Dublin?
Oh, it was absolutely disgusting incident that happened. I was out there in the street minding my own business when a group of young people came up to me and first threw a racial slur in my direction and then grabbed my face and decided that just spit on me.
Oh, my God. So were you on your own or what?
Yeah, I was. I was just on the street there waiting for a friend.
And they physically grabbed you?
They did indeed, yeah. So and they shook my face.
But that's assault, Una.
It is. No, it totally is. Absolutely. I was sickened. I truly was. It was absolutely appalling behaviour. This is something that I'm quite used to at this stage, but I've never been subject to physical assault.
And what do you mean you're used to it?
Growing up, you know, in Ireland, like, I mean, you mentioned that I'm of Vietnamese heritage. That's true, but I'm actually adopted. So I was adopted by a Kerry woman. I've been 21 years here now, basically, my entire life.
Yeah.
And I've been thrown racial slurs all my life. Really, you know, you get very desensitized to the whole thing, which is incredibly sad more than anything. But you do just kind of get to a stage where you just brush it off, you know. But I've never ever been subjected to a physical assault at all.
Did anyone intervene, by the way?
No, not a single person, no.
Because it's a busy street. It's a very busy street.
Oh, it was incredibly busy. It was rush hour at that stage. So no one came up, which I thought was incredibly sad as well, you know.
It's rough out there, and running a business is no easy station either, as Sean O'Rourke found out when he spoke with chipper owner Erica Loughran from the Genoa Cafe in Balbriggan.
These two lads came in, there was two ladies on the takeaway, and they were wearing like a cut t-shirt wrapped around their face. They had a hat, so you couldn't really see them, their face at all. And they came in with a kitchen knife and a steel bar. And they just asked for money, and I, you know, at first I kind of said, you know, just don't annoy me, get out here. And then they got kind of be aggressive, and there were one of the lads was heading for the tail, so I just fired the salt and the vinegar at them, and so they kind of panicked, and, you know, I just shouted at them, and I said I would just burn them with grease if they didn't leave, so they just ran out.
So it didn't take much in one sense to fend them off?
No, I don't know what happened. I just got so angry with them.
One of them, you say, had a kitchen knife and the other a metal bar. I mean,
yes, yeah. No, I just felt to protect them. I'm working very hard with what I'm doing. Like, I'm trying to cover my bills and we only opened and, you know, and I'm really working hard for this shop. And for a second, I just said, like, I'm not handing over anything. Do you know, we didn't have much on the tail because it's buy one, get one free. You don't get much money. All this anger came out of me because I said, like, how dare you come in, you know, just like that. And just the way I reacted, I just fired things at them. And if they didn't go, I think I was willing to fire, you know, to really use the oil, you know.
This is the deep oil in the deep fat fryer, is it?
Yes, yeah. So I know, like, you know, sometimes you're not supposed to do that. But, you know, I just felt so angry and, you know, frightened at the same time.
Erica Loughran with Sean O'Rourke on the News at 1. Well, the fine weather also brought out the turf cutters. Valerie Cox spotted these illegal bogmen on a designated bog in the west.
It's our livelihood. Like, sure, we have no ways of heating our house or anything without turf. Like, sure, they couldn't turf here this hundreds of years. My wife's father, his father before him, and his father before him again, could turf here.
But don't you know you're not meant to be cutting it anymore?
No one told me that.
But there were notices in all the newspapers.
And who said that I was supposed to buy a newspaper?
Have you never received any communication
about
this?
No, none whatsoever.
And would you stop cutting it if you did?
I want to keep cutting turf here. I want a fire for myself and that's it. What authority have they to take over for something that we own?
So you're going to keep cutting it?
So no one told me to stop.
And would you not be happy with the compensation?
Not at all. I don't want compensation. I want to be left alone. I'm 65 years.
And what age are you going to keep cutting turf up to?
While I'm able. The God might take me tomorrow and he might leave me here for 20 years. I don't know.
I don't have a choice. I need a source of fuel. Oil is far too expensive. And this is an honest, modest way of heating your house.
And if you were given an undesignated bog, yeah, would you move to it?
Would do for the sake of the environment, if that's necessary. We would move to an alternative site. There has been proposals put to the government and other sites identified. Unfortunately, there doesn't seem to have been any work whatsoever done on that relocation.
And what about the bog here? Do you think you're doing a lot of damage?
No. If we were doing the damage that people talk about, the bog would be long disappeared. And as you can see here, clearly the bog has not disappeared.
And how much cutting will go on here this year?
Everybody will cut a year's supply of fuel for the family home. You're talking in the region of 400 or 500 euros worth.
Valerie Cox reporting for the Today Show. Well, this week RTE announced that it would be axing its coverage of Premiership Soccer.
All right, well that's it. It's over, boys.
Yeah.
Premier Saturday Soccer has gone the way of Glenroe and Shogun O'Shea. Axed, like.
Huge mistake, Bill. If they think millions are tuning in to watch average footballers, yeah, like Van Persie and Gareth Bale, they're wrong. They're tuning in to watch me.
Well, look on the bright side, I suppose. We'll have our Saturday nights free.
To pursue cultural matters there, Bill.
I certainly will, John. Yeah. I'll be able to take the wife to bingo now.
Now, what about the movie spill?
Huh?
You're the film board chairman. You should be watching Man of Steel.
Oh, Fergie, yeah. Used to be a sheet metal worker. No. We'll miss him now. He's gone right enough.
The Lone Ranger is coming out there.
Well, I'm more of a Celtic fan. Thanks very much, John.
What about Pacific Rim, directed by Guillermo del Toro, Bill?
Huh?
His are multi-layered set pieces of quite startling complexity.
I have to agree with you there, Eamon. Del Toro, yeah, has to be one of the best defenders ever to play for Spain, like.
Now, Pacific Rim, Bill, like the Transformers.
Ah, yeah, the transfer window will be interesting, all right.
We should support Irish films on Netflix, Bill, like Intermission.
Great idea, John. We'll take a break.
Ah, for goodness sake, Bill.
Oh, you seem to have dropped your pen there, Eamon.
Righto.
Oliver Callan heard on Callan's Kicks last night.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
Nelson Mandela, the revered former president of South Africa, once again fought the rigours of old age this week in a Pretoria hospital. When Mr. Mandela was imprisoned for years by the apartheid regime, Tony Hollingsworth orchestrated the media campaign to change Mandela's image from black terrorist leader to statesman.
I went to see Archbishop Trevor Huddleston, who was the president of the anti-apartheid movement in Britain at the time, in 1987, and said to him that I thought that the way the anti-apartheid movement and the ANC were campaigning had reached a glass ceiling, that everything that they were doing was angry protest and on the streets, and therefore was in a sort of negative space, and that we needed to move them into a positive space, one that was warm, confident, and implicitly right for government.
So Tony Hollingsworth organised the Nelson Mandela 70th birthday tribute at Wembley Stadium in 1988.
For a long time, they were campaigning for the release of all political prisoners. But in the early 80s, it started to be more and more focused on Mandela. And I said, if the policy now is to get Mandela released as the key to ending apartheid, then we have a real problem on our hands in that 50% of the world's news on television and radio report Mandela as a black terrorist leader. So we need to do two things. We need to create a campaign that paints everyone warm and comfortable and fit for people's living rooms, not on the street. But specifically, we need to get rid of that word terrorist. So what I designed was this project called the Nelson Mandela 70th Birthday Tribute, a musical tribute to the man that would be broadcast around the world. And it was that that was going to get rid of this word terrorist. We will go to the entertainment divisions of broadcasters and say, would you like to broadcast a musical tribute to Nelson Mandela? And they will say, we're not allowed to broadcast politics. Can you assure us this isn't? And I'll say, no, it's a musical tribute to a man. But then they would be faced with an internal conflict. The heads of the entertainment divisions that have signed the contracts would then, in the next few weeks, listen to their news on their channel and realize that they were reporting Mandela as a black terrorist leader. Mm. And the heads of the entertainment divisions would pick up the phone to the news divisions and say, will you please stop calling him a terrorist? We've signed a contract for an 11.5-hour tribute to this man in 4 months' time. And 4 months before that event happened, that word had started to die from the media. He was no longer being referred to as a terrorist, but he was now a black leader. Not, of course, by everybody. Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of England, a month before that event, stood up in the House of Commons and said, as a question, how is it that the BBC can be broadcasting an event for a terrorist? And that will remind people how important that word was as a label to him in keeping the apartheid regime where it was. That was one of their main propaganda tools.
But getting artists to sign up for the concert wasn't easy.
Which artists did you have, and how easy was it to get them to sign up?
Well, at first it was very difficult. We think that for everyone that said yes eventually, they'd already said no nine times and maybe seven times before they said yes. But the first act that in fact committed to doing that in an unequivocal way was Dire Straits. And in 1988, that was the largest act in the world. And on top of that, we were able to add Miriam McCabe, Hugh Masekela, Simple Minds, Whitney Houston, George Michael, Sting. It went on and eventually was 83 artists in total. 83 artists to 600 million people for 11.5 hours.
He actually was released very shortly thereafter, and then you did it all again.
14 months after that first broadcast, his lawyer, Ishmael Ayob, came to see me in London and said, would we produce a second one to give Mandela a platform to speak to the world for as long as possible unedited? My request of them was that his first words on the stage to the world should be, thank you. In fact, he did it far more beautifully, of course. He said, thank you that you chose to care.
Tony Hollingsworth on his campaign for Nelson Mandela, a great man, a great fighter, and an enduring inspiration to us all. Well, I'll leave you now with a song from that Wembley concert in 1988. It's from The Specials. Gromagov as were Goluther, Tasulam Gurwanshev, Salt Tasaglor, August Gameshavlum, Taka and Amakiana, and Tachtan Shahuggin, Gajishin, Gajeshapslan.